very much in favor of unmanned spacecraft. You get a lot of bang for the dollar. Maintaining a human being in space, hard. It's expensive. It's dangerous. There's only 10 ways that that spacesuit can kill you. Drown you, not give you enough oxygen, not give you the right air pressure, develop a puncture, the wrong temperature. Oh my goodness. There's a lot of things that gotta go right for you to survive an EVA. And our astronauts have demonstrated a reasonable amount of grief as these unanticipated failures take place. As careful as they are with checking everything before they go into an EVA, I don't think I'd want to live day to day on Mars where the only way I can walk out of the habitat is to put on a spacesuit. And without walking out of the habitat and putting on the spacesuit, there's no way you're going to be exploring that territory and finding the things that you think are going to be valuable, and running your farm if you've got a farm up there. And to run a farm with less than 1% air pressure and it's the wrong components of air, I don't think, and you get a small fraction of the normal amount of sunlight, because Mars is considerably further away from the sun than the Earth is. Let me drop this. So the yield of your farm on Mars, I don't know if anyone has estimated it, but I'll be amazed if you're getting 1% of the yield that you would get on a farm on Earth. That's on the assumption you've got all the mobility by which you can do all of this farming. And if you're not going to farm your own food, all the consumables have to be brought up to you from planet Earth to Mars. I think the cost of that is just out of sight. 130 watts, 24/7, is generated by your body. All the raw materials for your body to metabolize to that level, 450 BTUs per hour of heat output of your body. If you're alive, you are doing that. The raw data has to be supplied. One of the estimations I made is that if you've got this great big sledge and you think you're going to walk across Antarctica, and you've got a whole lot of food on the sledge in the super cold weather and sometimes super high wind, and you run out of the propane gas by which you heat your food, at first it sounds like a minor detail. You think, well, I can't melt snow to make water. Well, I'll just put some of the snow in my mouth and let it melt. Your body has to make a pretty big investment to get water out of that. You're taking this material at minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, warming it up to 32 degrees Fahrenheit so that it melts. Then you're converting it from the solid form to the liquid form, 80 calories per gram. And then after that, you're taking this 32-degree water and warming it up to 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit so your body can use it. Think you're going to scoop up some snow and put it in your mouth and now you're going to be drinking. That's a huge investment. You run out of the propane fuel to heat your food while you're walking across Antarctica. It's almost as bad as running out of food. Again, we forget about some of the minor details as to what is required to maintain human life. We're complicated. We need a lot of stuff. Ain't easy. And every one of those molecules that comes out of you, all of the gaseous, liquid, and solid waste that comes out of your body, lots of it per year. I could tell you the volume and mass of that. I don't have to. Let me drop it. On planet Earth, Mother Nature takes every single one of those molecules and recycles it. Every breath you take contains molecules of air that were once inside the lungs of every human being that ever walked this planet. It's all being reused. To get all of that reusing taking place on the space station or on a Mars mission or on a lunar mission, very difficult. Am I being overly pessimistic here, Paul? WS2N? Give us some positive news on this one. Can't you always have your...
I wouldn't want to do that. I mean, you know, first thing I'd want to do is bring about 100 Whoppers to think of, you know, from Burger King. Because there's no meat there. You know, there's no cows, there's chickens, there's nothing. So even if I bought 100 Whoppers, what does it take? 200, I think it's 200 days, roughly 208 days to get to Mars. So even if you, ate vegetables every other day and a Whopper every day, your 100 burgers are already gone by the time you get there. Now you got another at least 6 months, maybe a year on Mars if you're coming back. You got live a life as a vegetarian. Now, that would make me nuts. I couldn't do it. But, you know, there's plenty of vegetarians that would probably think nothing of it. Oh, good, I'll go. How about going down to the South Pole, you know, McMundo Station or the actual South Pole? They've got like a dozen science stations down there. All the different countries have their own science stations. That might be fun. I've read a little bit about the life on Antarctica. That sounds like a blast. Always look for the hams, you know, 20 meters when they're transmitting. Haven't got one yet. I've heard them, but, you know, the pileup is just too much. Back to you, Jim.
I'm having trouble remembering his call letters or name. A good buddy, VHF, member of the Jewish group, Northeast Weak Signal Society, who lived in New Hampshire. And I went and picked up a dish out of his backyard and brought it home. Anyhow, he decided to take one of these deals where you live in Antarctica for 18 months at a time and you get a nice bonus pay if you last the whole time. And he's gone on two or three of those missions. He brought a lot of 432 megacycle antennas and transmitters down there and set it up and did some moon bounce. So he had some reasonable enjoyment out of it. But when you live in an environment like that, as I've lived in the Mojave Desert of California at Edwards Air Force Base for a month at a time, and you come back to the rest of the world and you suddenly realize, boy, do I miss the color green. In the Mojave Desert, everything is that light tan, brownish color. Very few things are green. In the case of Antarctica, everything is white or that yucky green that they paint all the buildings with. And soon you leave there and you look at the rest of the world, you say, boy, it's pretty. All of those colors, I've never seen them down there in that icy environment. And living through a winter in Antarctica, people can describe that to you, and it's just out of this world. Let me drop. So, go slow in some of these decisions, you guys. It may sound good on paper. Actually doing it, I don't know. Something very pleasant happened to me this week. I'm going to tell you guys about it. A couple of weeks ago, I had 20 inches of snow in my yard, which means not a chance in the world of moving my car through that. I've got a 90-foot long driveway, two cars wide, something like 30 feet wide. Therefore, 5,000 cubic feet of snow had to be removed off my driveway so that my family could move the cars. And I own a snowblower. I bought it from Home Depot a couple of years ago. And in the beginning, it worked like a charm. Slows snow out at 43 miles an hour. Throws the snow nice and far, nice and fast. And as long as you don't hit something like a newspaper and jam up the internal mechanism in the front where it shears the pin, as long as you don't run into a newspaper under that snow or a rock, you're in pretty good shape. Let me drop it. But after I bought it 4 or 3 years ago, whatever it was, I made the mistake of leaving fuel in the tank, not turning off the on-off valve for the tank, and fuel was slowly driving, dumping into the carburetor and evaporating, and more fuel dumped in. So the carburetor got real gummed up. I took it all apart and cleaned out the gumming, I thought. Now when I run that snowblower for the last year, it runs in cycles. It's pulsating. It can't run smoothly. So that it goes to the right velocity on each half cycle and half that velocity on each half. So it's moving a lot slower, not throwing the snow as fast, and you're continuously listening to the cycling of speed. I knew something was not right in the carburetor. And I was on Limock while driving in my automobile 2 weeks ago. And I made comments about the fact that my snowblower works pretty good, but... And along came David, KD2, Fox Victor Zebra. He says, I know what the problem is. It's those extra fine holes in your carburetor. You've got to take apart a couple more of the mechanisms that look like you shouldn't be touching them. And you got to clean it out. And I'll send you a website that describes this. Let me drop.
Question?
And the website is http://outdoorpowerinfo, all one word, outdoorpowerinfo.com/repairs. In my case, /Tecumseh_Cobb_64017.asp. You go to that website. and he gave you a whole bunch of pictures as to how to take apart that carburetor and a whole lot of similar carburetors. So before I proceed, go ahead and read your question, Joe.
I have done the same thing to my snowblower by doing exactly the same thing you did. I learned afterwards to use stable in the gas. I use that all the time. Do you use that?
If I had half a brain, I would have done that. I would have done two things. Use stable in the gas. I also would have turned off the fuel. I would have drained the tank, drained the bowl, turned off the valve. A whole lot of things I would have done right. And I thought when I cleaned the carburetor, I'd be back in operation. I wasn't. By way of that website, it'll show you that when you've got that fairly standard carburetor, and you take it apart a little bit further, there's a little bit of a needle valve-like mechanism in there that has one transverse hole that's about a 16th of an inch in diameter. It's very easily seen. But one end fire hole and a little needle valve-like mechanism, which has a hole that's much smaller than a number 60 drill. It's probably a number 75 or number 80 drill. In order to clean out that tiny little air hole, I had to take apart a stranded wire and take one or two strands of the wire and poke it in there. When I finally cleaned out this little needle valve-like mechanism and put the carburetor back together, as I did yesterday afternoon, and now for the first time in 2 years, my snowblower runs real smoothly. What a huge improvement. Nobody was under normal circumstances would take apart the carburetor to that degree. You think you're violating some of the vital adjustments. Turns out these other things you take apart are not adjustable. Let me drop.
Test tomorrow, 8 inches.
Now I'm ready. I've got this smooth running snowblower that now is back into running at a constant speed. Sounds beautiful. And throws the snow again at 43 miles an hour out of that chute. My goodness, can that thing move a whole lot of snow in a hurry? I get so excited that I was tempted to volunteer to go to my next door neighbor and clean out his snow for him, because his snowblower also is in some form of state of disrepair. And these carburetors, when you really get down to this article of that website I just mentioned to you, one of the things that's not obvious is that you look very carefully inside the venturi of that carburetor. Off to one side, exactly in the area where the butterfly closes, are four tiny little holes that without a magnifying glass you can just barely see them. Fuel-air mixture must flow out of those four holes when you're at idling. They call it idling speed. It's really idling power. The governor mechanism is cycling that the butterfly mechanism in there, and periodically it goes to the so-called idling power when you're not under load. And so if it's not getting the fuel-air mixture, the machine goes into a stall, it backfires, the governor now demands full power, it speeds back up, and it's continuously cycling and backfiring, and it doesn't sound good. It doesn't work quite as well. It works, but doesn't work quite as well. And when that whole mechanism is properly cleaned out, and now your carburetor is working correctly, what an improvement. I've now got to do the same thing to my lawnmower. And yes, I'm going to be using more stable. So it's a well-kept secret. Not many people know about it. And David, KD2, FVZ, brought that to my attention a couple of weeks ago. And my goodness, does that work well. I wonder if anyone else has had anything like a similar experience. I think the average person, let me drop, goes to his repair shop complaining that, hey, my motorized thing, my snow blower, my lawn mower, my leaf blower, any of these motorized things is now running terrible. In reality, the carburetor needs super cleaning, so to speak, and disassembly. I bet in many cases the service person you go to would just sell you a brand new carburetor for some ridiculous price. And because the repair procedure, it did take me probably 2 hours. And I think a repair person couldn't possibly charge you enough money for the repair to use the old. He just slaps a brand new one in there and charges you a nice price for it. Has anyone else run into any similar problems like this? Give me a call, letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Enjoy, DJ.
Hey, Dave, how's your snowblower working?
I'm going to call you up and ask you to come over. Because, well, my question is, did you perform the maintenance procedure that Dave told you about on the air, where you take a little wire or a paper clip and, insert it in those holes? Is that what you did, or was there something else?
In aircraft that looks like a paperclip. On my particular carburetor, that so-called fine needle valve is part of the idler mechanism. Required me to poke a piece of wire in there, which was two strands of what was probably 18-gauge stranded wire, which probably contained about 18 strands. Two of those strands would fit into that hole. And when I cleaned out that hole where some gum was in there, that made the difference. Something so minor. What I think is going on is that air has to be sucked into that hole along with the fuel that's being going through the transverse holes of that mechanism, and now that very fine misty fuel air mixture gets squirted out of these four extremely fine holes that are on the side of the carburetor, right in the vicinity of where the butterfly closes. As that butterfly closes, that very exotic fuel air mixture at the idling speed has to come out of those very fine holes through that whole mechanism. There's a hell of a lot more going on with all kinds of holes and crazy directions inside of this very simple-looking carburetor from the outside on each of these machines. So in my case, it was a very fine wire, only 100 times more fine than a paperclip, Dave. N2APG, K2RIW.
Yeah, very cool. Dick, just give me that website again with the video. I'd like to take a look at that, learn more about this. Sounds like you got some great information, and must be proud that you're able to do it yourself.
Hey, they can get tip cleaners for a torch. They work good.
What's the approximate diameter, Paul, of a tip cleaner? If I had to make a guess, the wire that I could stick in this little tiny hole that had to be clear was 1 or 2 thousandths of an inch in diameter. How fine are the tip cleaners you're talking about, Paul?
Very fine. They come in a little kit, you know, you pop it open, you know, and then you have like 20 of these different sizes, you know, from small all the way to, relatively large, which large is probably, maybe 1/30, probably less than 1/32nd. So, you know, you have all these different cleaners down to, like you said, a hairline number. And some of them, or most of them, have like a little burr on, you know, halfway down, so manage to get it into a torch head to clean it out. The burrness on it will actually help you clean it out. But in your case, you would use just the fine ones, and that would probably be good enough. It cleans out all the little divvy holes and stuff on a torch. I think John knows what I'm talking about, too. Any welding supply company would have it. You know, you're not going to get it all on. Back to you, Dick.
I'm sorry to hear it's not in Walmart. I own a set of drills that go from number 1 to number 60. And the number 60 drill is way too big. Somewhere in my house, I've got this tiny little set of drills that go from number 60 to number 80. I needed that, but couldn't find it. So I had to use other pieces of wire. All the pieces of wire I own, bus bars and whatever, even for very fine work, were much too big. I had to take individual strands out of stranded 18-gauge wire to finally solve this problem. That website, Dave, is, there's no www in this one. It's http://, followed by outdoor power info. Outdoor power info, all run together, .com/repairs, plural, / in my case, Tecumseh, Tecumseh, _ ARB, _ 640017, .ASP. I think if you just get the original portion of that URL, outdoorpowerinfo.com/repairs, after that you can choose Tecumseh and all these other brand names, and choose the one that's got the pictures that's close enough to your carburetor. The pictures I found were not exactly my carburetor. My carburetor is on a, let me drop this. My carburetor is on, I think it's a Liquid Technology Corporation engine. That's part of an Ahrens 24-inch high
snowblower that came from Home Depot three or so years ago. So I didn't have the exact carburetor, but it gave me enough hints. It was close enough. And I found disassemblable things that ordinarily I'd be afraid to go that far. I thought there were adjustments in there. They weren't. When I finally cleaned it out, I didn't think that was going to do it, but it ran like a charm. And so I'm very happy about this procedure. Anyone else have any further questions? Give me your call letters right now. K2LAW.
K2, Jack.
Go ahead, Eric. I wonder if you run into something like this.
Well, not on a lawnmower, but when I was younger, I used to rebuild MGAs and MGBs. Little pilot holes in the SU carburetors clog up from larger gas, stuff like that. Rather than take the whole thing apart, what I used to do is you got to be careful that there's no rubber component where you're doing it. You take that section off, dump it in a little tin of xylene, and leave it for a couple of hours. And you don't have to poke any holes in it. It cleans anything out. Make sure that there's no polymers or rubber materials that you're dumping it in, otherwise it just disappears.
In my case, Eric, the little mechanism that I had to clean out by poking wire in it was so deep inside of the carburetor, that little hole was so fine, I'm worried about soaking it in any material to hold on carburetor as a unit. Would it get down to that point and clean out that tiny little bit of gum that was creating all this grief? In my case, the grief was being caused by a hole, a precision hole, that looked to me like it's 1 or 2 thousandths of an inch in diameter. Air has to flow through that hole to create the right frothing of the fuel that gets squirted through those four micro holes on the side of the throat of the venturi of the carburetor. Boy, does that make a difference in the way the machine runs. So I wouldn't trust doing this anything except a disassembly. And if you've got strong enough chemistry that could get in there, I'm a little bit afraid it would be dissolving some of these O-rings and other plastic parts. You've even got to be careful when you use gum out and squirt it in there. Let me drop.
Question.
You've got to be careful that you don't over-pressurize things where there's a rubber bulb, which is part of the priming mechanism. I'm going to make sure you don't over-inflate that. Person with a question, give us your call letters and name and proceed. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
I agree with you, Dick. The thing is that you could take it apart to the point where you didn't have to take the whole mechanism apart, but the xylene will dissolve any kind of gum, even in it like a 10,000th of an inch hole. By the way, if you want really tiny drills, there's a company called Tinker and Think, and they basically sell drills for PC boards, and they come very, very tiny.
Yeah, the next problem is I'm going to buy those drills. I'm going to say, where do I have to store this? Oh, yeah, the so-and-so shelf. And I go there, and I'm going to find two more of them. Where do you buy xylene? The question person we're going to get to in a second. Where do you buy xylene? That's a fairly lethal substance. Eric, go ahead.
Well, believe it or not, you can buy it at Home Depot if you want. But this is years ago. It wasn't Home Depot. You used to have to get it from the distributor.
So you say if I go to the chemistry, if I go to the paint aisle of Home Depot, I might find xylene in the can?
Yeah, you will, along with some other types of solvents.
Okay. Person who had a question, give us your call letters and name, sir.
Good evening, Dick. This is Kate, Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa. Name is John. And I just wanted to know, what time are you going to be here tomorrow to snow blow out my driveway?
Okay, would 8 in the morning be too early?
Thank you for the offer, but I'll be gone. Thanks a lot. You guys take care. And thank you for the tank, Matt.
I guess you're saying that you travel to your place of business starting at 7 in the morning. Is that what you're saying?
Affirmative.
Oh, well. That's too bad. Yeah. A properly working snowblower. He is a pleasure to use. When you compare the back-breaking labor of, in my case, 2 weeks ago, I would have had to move 5,000 cubic feet of snow. Nice, fluffy snow. That's the good news. Hadn't started melting and getting icy yet. But still, that's an awful lot of labor. That's, in my case, I think at my rate these days, that would be an 8-hour day, as opposed to 40 minutes with a snow blowing, maybe 30 minutes with a snow blowing. Huge difference. So even though I've got a rather inexpensive, not anywhere near top-of-the-line snow blower, when properly maintained, does the job. It's all I need. Anybody with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now, K2RAW.
WS2N.
You got it, Paul.
Snow-related topic, but a little different. Something I got this year that I've never bought before. I don't know if you've ever seen these things. They're called roof brakes. And you're able to get a lot of snow off the first 2 to 4 feet of your house, you know, from the gutter up. And the reason I got it is a couple of years ago I had a situation where wound up with a leak, creating an ice dam situation. I said, I'm not going to have this again. But it's got a lot of other purposes, you know. You can use it on, for instance, your car. I must have had 8 to 10 inches of snow just recently. Instead of doing it one way, you just use this roof brake. And I've used it in a couple of other spots, too, on my shed, rather than have the potential of this shed collapsing, you know. It's a good tool. I don't know if you've ever seen this thing.
Okay, who sells the roof rake? Roughly how many dollars? How long have you owned it? Sounds like you're very happy with it. And that sounds like a darn good way of avoiding an ice dam. I had a lot of snow on my roof, but it melted in a way that surprised me. A lot of the snow overflowed my gutters and then refroze itself with great big long icicles. But apparently the last time the roofing had been done in my house, they must have done a good job. I didn't develop any ice dam, but it looked like I should have. So this snow rake for a tip-roof ranch-style house. Roughly how many dollars and where'd you buy it, Paul? Go ahead.
And of course, it eliminates all the potential ice sickle problems in front of my house, especially. I wind up with these icicles all the time. It's on the north side of the house, and no matter what you do every day during the winter, you know, if you don't get any kind of a thaw, I'm constantly putting salt out there. Now I don't have to bother with that anymore. It's just the reason for the salt is the ice. You know, you wind up with these 3 foot icicles, and they're dripping down, and they hit the steps, and they hit the walkway, and it turns into a ice skating rink. You think it's all good, and the next day it's back, you know. Meanwhile, it didn't even snow. It's about $50. It's not cheap, but it really works well. It opens up. It's all telescopic to about 17 feet, and I'll probably use it in the springtime to move a branch or two away from my dipoles. You can reach up pretty high with this thing. It's very strong. Very strong setup. I was kind of surprised. Works good. Back to you there.
So around $50. Is that a Home Depot product or a... I can't think of the name of the other great big store like that. OU Paul?
Yeah, I tried to get it last year. I got it low, by the way. I tried to get it. Ace would have it, or Home Depot would have it. Well, last year with the ice, we remember last year. We had 60 days in a row, and never one above freezing. So naturally, they were all 100% gone. And I got this before, during all the good weather that we were having. It didn't look like we were going to even have one snowstorm. And they must have had 50 of these things in the store in Lowell's. But I wouldn't be surprised if I went back there and they were all gone. And the first time I heard about this, one guy used to travel up to Michigan back in the early 1980s. And he was talking about a roof rake. And what are you talking about? This is what people do. They get the snow off their roof up in Michigan on a regular basis. Back to you.
So you bought it at Lowe's, and Lowe's is the name of the other place I couldn't think of. Okay, it's good to know. The good news is that these places like Lowe's, Home Depot, Walmart, did lots of good stuff at good prices. Fortunately, unfortunately, when they move into your town, they displace all the mom-and-pop businesses that have been there for generations. Some of the people in other parts of the United States are now very unhappy that Walmart moved in, displaced all the mom-and-pop places. Walmart decided to close the store, so now they've got nothing. And they got to drive 50 miles to do any shopping. So that's a bit unhappy. And as you probably heard me guys say, my favorite place to go to get the kinds of glasses I like to wear, Ada style and real glass, not plastic. I used to go to Wise Eyes, and they were still selling those a few years ago. And I went there recently. Let me drop.
By the way, it's made in Mexico. Very well made, by the way, Dick.
It's good to know. So I go to my Wise Eye local store a couple of months ago, and they told me that their frame supplier no longer supplies to them aviator-style frames, supply one of these tiny little frames that I don't like, and they no longer supply lenses that are made out of glass, to which I told the place, the lady running the store, in about a year, you're going to have to make a decision. She says, what? I said, you're going to have to decide where your new job is going to be. I think you've allowed your suppliers to dictate your business into a way that you're likely to go out of business. You were supplying the one thing I couldn't get anywhere else. Well, I walked into Walmart, and I asked them about aviator-style frames. They said, yeah, we got about 10 of them over there. Choose the one you like. And can you supply me with lenses made out of glass? We don't like to. We're afraid it's going to crack. I said, that's the last thing I worry about. I want real glass. I want to be able to take a piece of Kleenex or any other piece of paper and simply rub the stuff that's on my glasses without creating scratches. With real glass, I can do that. Let me drop. The good news is there's a lot of fluid in my eyes, as it should be. The bad news is walking down my eyelashes and ending up on the glass, and I have to clean my glasses 10 times a day. And 10 times a day, I have to find water to wash them because they're plastic. That'd be a pain. I can choose any old piece of paper with glass, and it works like a charm. And everybody thinks glass is heavier. They don't believe that. The plastic they make the modern lenses out of has a lower index of refraction. So you need more of it. Is it really lighter? And what are we talking about? A fraction of an ounce of difference in weight on your nose because of the weight of the lens? I want real glass. And so I found a way to get it. Now, another big repair I had to do this week that worked out very well. Let me drop.
I agree with Walmart. One of the few places I can get trifocals, real trifocals.
And for these individual stores to take something like aviator-style frames and discontinue them, a significant percentage of the senior citizens in the United States have fallen in love with the large lenses of aviator-style glasses, where you can look up, down, left, right, and you're not looking beyond the lens. You're covered, if you know what I mean. We like the looks and the operation. Yeah, it's not modern. People think that these tiny little square, so-called designer frames are better. I doubt it. Do that if you want. It's not me. So when you've got all of these senior citizens that I know, a high percentage of using aviator-style glasses, and for a frame supplier to say, oh, we're going to discontinue that. Craziness. Okay. I do my own oil burner repair. And every time I get an oil delivery, spot delivery, and I'm getting oil these days at ridiculously cheap prices because I'm not part of anybody's contract. The good news, I get oil when I need it at a very nice price. And the guy that supplies it to me, I call him up, and within an hour, he's there. And no schedule required, no contract, no nothing. And I usually put 8 ounces of this blue fluid, I think it's called a fuel conditioner. I pour that into the tank just before the delivery, so it all gets mixed together. And that usually takes control of water, sludge, and whatever that's in the tank. I've got an external tank, an internal tank inside the house, 275 gallons, so-called. Let me drop. So the design of my house is such that the oil tank is on the southern end of the house, and the furnace is on the western side, almost 30 feet away. And the pipe that runs from the oil tank to the furnace is under the concrete floor of my basement. And so I put in this fuel conditioner, this blue fluid,
every year. It's gotten a little pricey these days from Sid Harvey that supplies the rural parts. I put that in there, and it's kept it very clean for the last couple of years. Well, all of a sudden, I can tell by the vacuum gauge I've got on the filter that the vacuum is starting to run high, and pretty soon my my fuel pump on the furnace became starved. And at first I thought it was a clogged filter. It wasn't. It was a clogged pipe. And I owned this little CO2 gun. Well, it cost me a few dollars when I bought it 15 years ago. This device that's about 4 inches long, about 3 inches in diameter, and you put a CO2 cartridge in it, you connect it to the pipe, flare fitting, that goes back to the tank, and as you turn the outer shell of this thing, it punctures the CO2 cartridge and sends CO2 at high pressure down your pipe, and it clears the pipe. Worked like a charm. Now I'm back into a warm house, if you know what I mean. A rather simple procedure. Very few people know about that. So cleaning out a clogged pipe is easy. And if you've done what I'm doing, let me drop.
Comment.
I'll get you in a minute, Joe. I don't simply put a filter in the fuel line that goes to my oil-fired hot water heater and oil-fired furnace. I've got two filters. I went and bought two separate filter containers. One of them is the large container, which puts the great big felt filter in that's got multiple rings to it. That does my coarse filtering, followed by one of these white foam, very fine filters. So I got two filters that I've established in series. Does a beautiful job of filtering the fuel. If I had nothing but the fine filter, it would clog in a month. I'd be changing the darn filter every month. If I had nothing but the coarse filter, there'd be enough fine grit getting through that it would be creating wear on the nozzle. And my nozzle these days is now at the recommendation of the nozzle company. John, when I go over to Joe, he's going to tell me the brand name of the nozzle company. I keep forgetting. I'm now running the nozzle at 150 pounds per square inch. I got a gauge on the pump. I got a gauge, a vacuum gauge on the filter, so I know what's going on. All I got to do is look at these gauges, and I can troubleshoot everything that fails on my furnace. Let me drop.
Delvin.
Delvin is the name. So you Google the word Delvin, and you look at that 10-page book of theirs that gives you everything you want to know about nozzles for oil burner. Very good information. There's a huge improvement. If you turn the adjustment screw on your oil pump of your furnace up to 150 pounds per square inch. So I've got a pressure gauge on each of my pumps that I can see the 150 pounds per square inch. I get a vacuum gauge on the second filter so I can tell when it's trying to suck fuel and having trouble. So if I'm not getting heat, I can very easily do troubleshooting. Do I have electricity? Do I have oil pump? Do I have ignition? Is the fuel flowing? Are the gauges reading the right way? All I got to do is look at the gauges and do a little bit of study. And most of the time, I can troubleshoot within a very small amount of time. Almost any kind of failure I get with my oil burner system, which I maintain for the last 30 years.
Dick, K2 UPS has a comment.
K2 Jay with a question. Okay, we're going to go to Joe first, Rich second, Eric third. Go ahead, Joe, with your question or comment. W2LYY, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, I don't know what kind of system you have. I have a two-pipe system on mine where there's a return line going back to the tank. Some people have that, some people don't. And an interesting problem happened with the return line because I cleaned out the supply line with a high-pressure air hose, which does the same thing as your CO2 stuff. Top is the same thing. And later on this year, I had to clean out the return line because apparently it was getting clogged and not letting a sufficient supply of fuel back into the tank. And it actually seemed like it was stalling out the oil pump on start. It was the compressor. It was causing the compressor to lock up and trip the breaker in the ball motor. Many times I find the thing tripped, and I couldn't figure out why until I cleaned up the second pipe. And I only had to do this after I put the new oil pump on and raised the pressure to 150 psi. Back to you.
I'm going to make a guess on that one. When the oil is now being pressurized to 150 pounds per square inch, and all the oil that you don't use, having been pressurized and going by your
pressure valve mechanism is now being squirted back into the return pipe. I'm going to make a guess that the amount of heating of that oil, when it's been through a pump, raised to 150 pounds per square inch, been through an orifice that allows it to go back to the return pipe, the overflow oil, that heating may increase the possibility of it turning into sludge. So where I've only got a one pipe system, all the oil that flows down my pipe goes into the compressor is not the right word, into the pump, and goes into the nozzle and gets burned. So I'm not quite sure what the advantage is of the return two pipe system as opposed to one, because with the two pipe you don't have redundancy. You still have to have fuel being supplied by the main pipe, but you don't have heat. So I know there's a lot of people who have that design. I'm not quite sure why it exists in some cases. We'll eventually find that out. Let's see what Rich's got to say about all of the above. KTUPS, Mobile. Maybe still in Pennsylvania, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Toronto, Toronto, Toronto.
Hi, Dick, KTUPS. Now, the other comment I was just going to make was about the oil burner, but before we were talking about the snow blows and clearing out your driveway and not having a four-wheel drive vehicle, I think it's been mentioned before, but you might want to check into something called auto socks or snow socks for the car. It's a very tough mesh fabric. It's kind of like a bag, like, you know, potatoes or vegetables that's coming from the supermarket, and it's sized for the tire on your car. They fold up, they fit in the glove box. Your wife will have no trouble putting them on, and they work just about as good as chains. It's really amazing. It's basically just like a large woven plastic bag that goes around the rubber tire, and you don't have to lift the car up to put them on or anything. It takes you not even 2 minutes to put them on. But that's something that you might want to have in your car in the wintertime. Take back to you.
One of the great advantages I have is that I'm on a county road, which is the first thing that gets plowed, and it gets plowed every half hour whether it needs it or not. In fact, I've got to put up a whole lot of reflectors to make sure they don't plow down my my berm to keep the water from pouring off the road onto my property. So I've got a clear road to drive on, and with my snowblower, I've got a clear driveway to drive on. So 99% of the time, I might not need snow socks. It's quite possible you use them on your vehicles where you go through some pretty rough territory from time to time. But it's good to know. Let's see what Eric has wanted to say about all of the above. KE2EJ, I'll bet you burn gas in your house, Eric. K2LAW in the tech man.
India Whiskey. India Whiskey, Toronto.
My question to you, Dick, is, I converted this house to gas. The house of the story that you visited, I was oil. And eventually I converted to gas. I heard you mention that the pipe running from your tank to your burner is a good 30 odd feet. And I believe you said it was under the cement. Was that correct?
That's a big 10 for a good buddy. It's under the concrete between the tank and the burner. And I can't get there, Rick. Go ahead.
All right, the reason why I asked is because what I found, especially in the older houses, after about 50 or 60 or 70 years, it's like the lime in the cement puts little pinholes in the copper pipe. And for years we didn't realize it. You could just smell a little hint of oil until it started leaking to the point that you knew that it was leaking. Well, that took a few years, but I'm wondering if you're aware of that.
And no, I'm not, Eric, and I'm going to keep an eye out for it. Because I'm keeping track of the number of gallons I burn, and I'm very happy with that number, and it's not changing. Or as I make improvements in the house, the number goes down. As I make improvements in the furnace, it goes down. And we both had warmer weather these days. So I'll keep an eye on it. And I've seen no evidence of that, but now I know something to look for. I hope they've got the right brand of concrete in my house that's not acetic enough to start eating into the copper pipe. If they've done a good job of that installation, maybe that's not a problem. Now, we've got somebody from the Golden Horseshoe, I think it's called, of Canada, DE3JIW. Go right ahead, Jim. K2RIW in the TechNet. Nice hearing from you again.
Okay, this is the E3JIW. Well, if I had my machine, I would shut off the gas flow and let it run until it uses up all the fuel in the carburetor. Until it just doesn't run, and pull a choke and try it some more, so I try and use up all the fuel. The second point, and I'm going to trip. Description of a snow rake. There's a YouTube video. Think of a U, flat bottom, vertical side, on a pole. And this U cuts through the snow on the roof. And you go up the roof with the U, this U shape, with the flat side down near the roof, maybe a runner to stop you snagging shingles. And it drags a piece of tarpaulin that gets underneath the snow. And then the snow slides down this piece of tarpaulin off the roof. Is that off the roof? There's YouTube videos on it. Is that what you think of a snow rake, where it's dragging a sheet of plastic under the snow, and then the snow slides down the plastic off the roof? About an 18-inch wide U-shaped cutter that essentially cuts through the snow and drags plastic under the snow.
My goodness, that sounds very crafty, Jim. I'm going to go back to Paul, who indicated this snow rake. I wonder if it works in that manner. WS2N, is that describing the snow rake you got? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet?
I've seen that. No, this is different. This is just a, let's call it a big, long, wide hoe, you know, about 18 inches wide. And, reinforced. It's got stiffness coming off of it, so nothing bends. And it's an ABS plastic, so it's extremely very strong plastic. But no metal tip on it, so you know you're not going to go through. You're not going to damage your shingles or you gotta, you know. But I know what he's talking about. But no, this is different. But this is called a snow rake. Correction, it's called a roof rake. That's the actual name. Back to you.
Yeah, even though yours is made out of a stiff plastic, still being misused, I think it could create a little bit of damage to the shingles. And what Jim is describing is very crafty, not damaging the shingles. Does that have a special name? Roughly how many dollars? Is that something only sold to the smart people in Canada who get some serious snow? Would I be able to find that thing purchasable down here in the lower 48, Jim? BE3JIW, K2IW in the TechNet, and roughly how many dollars?
You can get it online, Jim, but not in the store. I looked.
Oh, no, I just saw it on YouTube, and it was probably a U.S. site. I'm in Toronto looking at a green, sort of nearly green lawn. I have no snow. And a newspaper article reported the amount of snowfall. And the U.S. snowfalls have exceeded the major snowfalls in Canadian cities over the years. When you guys get walloped, you get it big time. I mean, I've used, a snow shovel once this year. I used a leaf blower for the last snowfall, but I've got no snow. I go by the church, and they put the pile of snow in a pile. So, yeah, they have a pile of snow because it has melted. But I got no snow on my lawn, street, sidewalk, my fence, roof, house. I believe it's a U.S. product. YouTube was where I saw it. Not in a store. I've never seen this in a store.
Okay, that's very good to know. I'm glad you brought that to our attention, Jim. Now, where you live, I think that if the wind blows in the right direction, you should occasionally get lake-effect snow from Lake Michigan, Lake Ontario. And I've been in Toronto, or was it Montreal? Montreal. I was in Montreal one winter, and it was the first time I ever got exposed to snow lightning. I was kind of amazed. Couldn't figure out what the heck it was. So what are you doing these days so that you don't get any lake-effect snow up there, Jim? BE3JIW, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, the Georgian Bay lake-effect snow doesn't make it to Toronto. We're too far south. Buffalo got the snow because the snow can run along 100 miles of lake almost and then dump it on Buffalo. So Toronto can't get the lake effect snow because we're on the lake and there's not, that it doesn't have, the wind doesn't have the long distance to travel across the water and pick up the snow. To get Toronto, it's coming across the lake in, what, 30, 40 miles? I'm 2 miles from Lake Ontario, 10 miles west of CN Tower. The effect of the lake moderates the temperature in Toronto because Lake Ontario doesn't freeze anymore. Back in the 20s, my grandfather used to be able to drive his car out onto Toronto Island. And you can't get onto Toronto Island. Get onto Toronto Island by driving these years. The city has changed the temperature, the weather, locally. But no, Toronto can't get lake effect because we don't have the 100-mile run so the wind needs to pick up enough water. Buffalo got it because the straight-line wind off the lake dumped Buffalo like they've been walloped. Way worse than I've ever seen in my life. Like, I remember 76 winter seeing it on the coverage. Realize we get Buffalo TV as local TV. Back to that. And I know it's close to midnight, but hey, I could not find, by the way, the Echolink node numbers to make a connection, but I was listening on the internet and I had to come out and just drop a couple of words onto you tonight at the very end of a Sunday night.
Good evening. M2EO, my suspension is over, Dick.
Pretty fine, Rich. Jim, very glad you dropped in. And when it comes to the internet connection that Jim is looking for, I wonder if you have any of the numbers that might help him, John. KC2WGB, K2RW, the TechNet.
Dick, Jim can access the Linemark website, and right on the first page, it has a little article there about live. He can listen to it in real time. I think it's maybe a 2-second delay. Joe Gomez had that set up 2 weeks ago. It was announced on the TechNet, and that seems to be working well. That's about all I know. KC2WGB.
With the Limark.org, I guess it is, website, I know that you can do live streaming, so to speak, of the TechNet, but I think you hear it with a few seconds of delay, if I've heard correctly. And would that method of connection allow somebody like Jim to be able to talk back to us, KC2WGB, K2RIW? As you can tell, I'm pretty computer ignorant, John. Go ahead.
KC2WGB. No, Dick, it can only be used for monitoring, but if he wants to listen, it's pretty good. About a 2-second delay, but you can't transmit on it. That's for telephones, all the mobile equipment now. If he has a cell phone, you can just bring that up, and the guys say it's working great.
Okay, now let me repose the question. I'm not an Echolink user. A person living in the hinterlands, like Canada, far away from us is what I mean by hinterland, what does he do to make sure he has, the word I'm looking for, connectivity, Echolink connectivity to the TechNet while it's in process? A person living in the outer areas of the United States, what does he have to do to make sure he can get to us? Over to you, John, K2RIW. That may be a vague question. Maybe there's no simple answer. You got it, John.
Well, there is, and I'm sure Jim knows it. If you go onto a website and you type in Echolink, you'll bring up the Echolink information, and as long as you have a license and you can ID yourself, you can do that with a credit card. It takes about maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and you get an access to Echolink. It's very easy to do, and I'm sure they can do it in Canada because they're doing it in Mexico, so it should be no problem at all.
Yeah, you monitor the chat room and the Echolink website, if I understand correctly. The activity you saw tonight, which could be interesting because it was during Super Bowl 50, I guess you call it, the great big football game, how much traffic did you see on either the chat room or Echolink? By traffic on Echolink, I mean, or any other method of connection. Did you see a number of people from far away from the New York tri-state area? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
On the chat chat room, we had one from Florida, and a couple of others that were just making comments and describing what they were doing. So there was nothing there as far as technical questions, but there were a few people there. Now, on Echolink, we had 10, but they were mostly locals. I didn't notice anybody. There was nothing from Canada. None of the V numbers were in there, but all of them looked like they were local. But we had a good show tonight, 10. Usually there's between 8 and 10, and I didn't think we're going to have anywhere near that tonight with the Super Bowl.
Yep. So the beep goes away. You guys have listened to TechNet number 1588. And you listened to Space Report number 187. I think we're going to be back next week. For people who still want to listen to the jazz, they still want to discuss these subjects, even though there's a little bit of repetitiveness in them. And when it comes to understanding antennas, impedance match, local effects, transmission lines, VISRA, forward power, reverse power, reactive power, proper alignment of transmitters, proper sensitivity of receivers, propagation, all of this jazz connected with wireless. And even furnace repair and snow removal. We get into a little bit of everything. I think we'll be back next week. Be happy and enjoy this great hobby. Very educational. And John, I'll send it over to you. And thank you for your participation. KC2WGB, the microwave voice of Staten Island, K2RIW.
The beep is gone. Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. I'd like to thank everybody again, once more, for attending and the questions and enjoying the net. That's what it's all about. Be kind to each other, and if it goes well, we will be back next week. It's time. KC, back to you, Dick.
Let's see if Paul has any closing remarks. What's the next big thing that you know of that NASA is about to do, Paul? WS2N, K2IW, if you're still there.
Spend money.
There's always something. The next big thing, I'm waiting for the beam to go up. That, you know, to me, that's interesting. Yeah, module. But what's going to make the news is Scott Kelly coming back after 1 year. That'll be March 2nd, so that's a couple of weeks away. That should be good. But we're waiting for the crewed missions to take off from Florida, and we got to wait until probably early 2017. But we'll see the unmanned flights probably a little bit before that, you know, of a crewed vehicle as a test vehicle. So that should be pretty good.
We're being turned off. Bye-bye for now. Thank you.
This is Jim, BE3JOW. I'm going to check for double. I have Echolink on the iPad, and I found a K2 or a Whiskey 2 Romeo Victor website. I looked at the website. It does not list Echolink node numbers. It lists call signs. The Echolink app on the iPad is possibly different than on a Windows machine, but there is no node numbers on the website. They mentioned the IRLP. Anyway, I'll continue looking. 7-3. I can live stream. I got no problem with the live stream. Live monitoring Long Island, da-da-da-da-da. And it works flawlessly through the net. Doesn't get, usually does not drop out. Anyway, I made it through on RF. And still sounds busy down there. So I will say 7-3 and thanks for helping out. WGB, I think, of the E3IW.
Jim, if you're still listening, the node number is 226292.
292. Thank you very much. Now I got to run in before I forget. 226292.
All right, no problem. And it's Whiskey 2. W2VL Victor Lima is the call. I think you said Romeo Lima before, but you might have just misspoken. I don't know if you had looked up the right page or not, but it's W2VL online.
Disconnected.
Yes, I did find it. I just misspoke because I'm going by memory and the machine's inside and I'm sitting at the radio, not at the pad. Thanks again. 7-3.